Hi, everybody. On the podcast today, we get to talk to Eric Rinkus. Eric studied computer science at Michigan Technological University and graduated in 2014. Since graduating, Eric has worked as a software engineer at three different companies, Epic in Wisconsin, Consensus, a subsidiary of Target in California, and now YouTube, a subsidiary of Google, also in California. Outside of software engineering, he's an avid gamer and snowboarder, and recently has taken up mixology as a hobby at home as well. He enjoys doing hobby coding projects at home and was involved in competitive programming while at Michigan Tech. He was lucky enough to even be on a team that qualified for the ICPC World Finals in Russia in 2014. Eric, welcome to EYC. And we're back to EYC. Welcome, everyone. Really excited for this podcast today. Thanks for listening in. I got Brennan on the line. Brennan, how you doing, man?
I'm doing pretty well. Holidays are over now. So whenever you're listening to this, it's like the week after New Year's. I'm back at work, which is okay, but it's always nice to be on vacation. Like, that's what I guess would rather be doing most days, but you know, so can't complain too much, I guess.
Yeah, it's always hard to start getting back, you know, the first day, you know, everyone's chatting and talking about break. Seems like the first day is a wash because it's hard to get it to be productive. Like, if you're the guy on the day back to work after a holiday that's asking questions, trying to schedule meetings, I don't know. You don't want to be that person.
No, but then you're also like have to follow up on the emails you sent like yeah. 2 weeks before Christmas that no one answered. And you're like, well, I kind of still need an answer. So I guess I'm going to have to look at everything that didn't get responded to and then respond to all the ones I missed also. So I guess.
I wonder if there are people, there's got to be, I mean, there's people out there that get hundreds of emails a day. They must be the people that just like, just say, I'm going to just totally ignore everything that happened from the email perspective and just start fresh. I've heard of some people do that. Like, they'll just not respond. You know what I mean? They'll just say like, okay.
It definitely seems that way. It definitely seems that way.
Like, start today.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know.
Well, anyways, so on the show today, we have Eric Rinkus, a friend of mine back in the Michigan Tech days. Really excited to hear his story and hear everything he's got going on. So Eric, maybe let's start by kind of hearing your story in terms of how you got to where you are today.
For sure. Yeah. Thank you so much for having me on the show today, Troy and Brennan. It's really fantastic to get to talk about my experiences. So I started at Michigan Tech, started studying computer science there. I was there for 4 years. And when I graduated, my first job out of school was with a company called Epic Systems. They're in Madison, Wisconsin, and they work on electronic health records. Most hospitals around the country actually use their software to manage their patients' data. I was there for about a year, a little over a year. And then I went from there. I wanted to move out to San Francisco, as a lot of people probably know. A lot of the jobs for computer science, for software engineers, for tech in general is out west here in California. And so I came out here in 2015 to start working for a company called Consensus. And they are a electronic retail company. They're owned by Target. They run the electronics department for a lot of Target stores, software that runs in there to help sell connected devices and services, if you will. And then I was there for another year. And then landed at my current job at Google. I work on video infrastructure at YouTube.
Dang, that's a lot of different cool stuff. It sounds like just heading right after college and going into that. Have you enjoyed what you've been doing so far?
For sure, yeah. I'm definitely happiest at my current job. When I was at Epic, I was pretty antsy to get out of there. I always kind of thought of it as the sort of like first step after college and the sort of jumping board, I guess, for lack of a better term, to the rest of my career is kind of just a place for me to start. Not to knock when I was working there or anything like that. It just wasn't the right fit for me, I guess. And then moving to Consensus, I was pretty happy when I got a chance to come out here. I was around a lot of old Michigan Tech friends from the computer science department. And it was really nice kind of getting the more traditional Silicon Valley experience, I guess, in terms of being in the tech industry. But again, I was still kind of wanted something more out of my career and worked really hard to try to get the job here at Google. Actually interviewed twice for the job. So I was pretty stoked when I finally got it.
Yeah, it sounds like being out in Silicon Valley, being in San Francisco, working for Google is kind of like the dream that a lot of people aspire to, at least maybe in what we see if we're kind of around the fringes of computers and coding and software engineering, that getting out there and working for that is kind of like the dream position. Do you kind of feel like that's what it's been?
For sure. Yeah, that is definitely how I'm feeling right now. I will say that growing up, I knew I wanted to be a software engineer for a very long time. I was an avid gamer, mostly video games when I was younger. It's expanded to board games, tabletop role-playing games lately. So I've always wanted to design games, but I always knew that that was a tough industry to break into. As I got older and I started considering more options, what I could do working on computers, working on software, I sort of settled, my opinion settled on, I would love to work at Google someday. And it was super cool to finally have that opportunity this early in my career.
Yeah, that's awesome, man. It seems great. Seems like you're really enjoying it. It seems like the company culture is fantastic. I mean, there's different mixes and different things, but it sounds like the culture is what it's hyped up to be.
Yeah, for sure. I've been super happy with the team that I landed on there. I kind of got thrown into a subject area that I'm definitely not familiar with. I didn't have any experience with video processing when I was in college or even at either of my two previous jobs. And so I was a little scared when I first came into the job, you know, is this something I'm going to be able to do? Do I have the right level of expertise to do this sort of thing? But the team has been fantastic in welcoming me on, helping me grow. And the organization as a whole that I'm working within is absolutely fantastic. And it's been an awesome learning experience being there too, being surrounded by lots of brilliant minds.
Yeah, that's great. Can we maybe dive into that technically a little bit more? Like you talked about this idea of you didn't feel like you had the technical knowledge in that domain. Can you help me understand? So, I mean, just being again, like as Brennan said, like one of these kind of the fringe computer people, help me understand what you mean by the domain that you didn't understand. And then I guess how you felt like you were able to learn and develop in that domain.
Sure. So I work in the video processing pipeline for YouTube. As you all know, or you might or might not know, when you upload a video to YouTube, you can upload it in a variety of different formats. Typically, we think of a format as being a combination of a container and a codec. The codec being particularly important when we want to figure out how to compress that video so that we can send it over the internet more effectively. So since we support all of these different video formats that you can upload videos with, we also have to be able to support playback formats on a variety of different devices. Different devices have native support for decoding different codecs. And so we want to make sure that all of the different devices that you can play YouTube videos back on, whether it's an Apple device, a laptop, a TV, an Android device, what have you, all of those devices can receive a format of that video from YouTube that is playable on that device. So in general, that's kind of the problem space that my team and the larger video infrastructure group works within, and some of the other problems that kind of come along with that pipeline too. My team in particular works as an interface over this processing engine that does all of that work. So luckily, I haven't needed to have the fine detail expertise in how this is exactly is done, going from one format to another and back, that sort of thing. Like we call this process transcoding. I just have to worry about how do we design the best interface so that our various clients within Google, because we serve more than just YouTube videos, can interact with this processing engine in an effective way, and how my team can manage their video metadata effectively and serve their needs as best as we can.
That's great. So that was an experience that you didn't have, or like, I guess a domain that you hadn't worked in at all before. Can you talk maybe a little bit about how is it different to learn a different technical domain while still having the same fundamentals?
Sure. You come into a new domain and you might be writing your code in a language that you're familiar with, or even using libraries, some libraries that you're familiar with when writing that code. But the problem space, the algorithms you're designing, the kind of base knowledge that you need in order to solve some of these problems, you may not be equipped with. And so it's definitely intimidating coming into a new domain. Luckily, there's a large number of techniques within software engineering that are designed to be generally applicable to many different problem spaces. So it's definitely helpful to remember to, you know, if you're coming from college, you studied computer science for 4 years, to pull from some of those pieces of expertise that are likely reused in different problem spaces, just maybe slightly modified to better suit that problem space. It also helped me personally coming in to this group, knowing that I wasn't being put on the specifically on the transcoding team, that these are people that have master's degrees or PhDs in video processing, in image processing, what have you, similar domains. Rather, I'm working very closely with a lot of these experts in their field, which is fantastic. So I can learn from them about this problem space. But the problems that I'm personally working on my team were a little bit more familiar based on what I'd worked on at previous companies or in school. And I didn't really know that that was going to be the case when I first came into the job. But as I kind of started to settle into the job, get over the nerves about being in this new team, it started to kind of settle in that, okay, yeah, this is definitely something that I can do. And I have a fantastic team here to support me.
So Eric, I guess if there was one thing that you feel like school didn't prepare you for in this role, what would that be? And I'm thinking maybe along the lines of you obviously learned a lot of technical subjects, probably a lot of theoretical things too, as we all do often when getting a degree. But what are some of the things that maybe you weren't prepared for that are like much more commonplace in this area of software engineering?
So I think there are two different directions, I guess, for an answer that come to mind on this particular topic. The first being, like you said, technical. And I think that college tends to focus, especially when you're getting a degree in computer science specifically, that college focuses a lot on theory. There are a lot of very math-heavy courses that you take. And while that's fascinating and awesome and can put a lot of really, really good tools in your toolkit that are going to be foundational for what you're going to be doing in a real job, it doesn't really set you up for what it's like to write enterprise software. So I think a good example of something like that is when it comes to, say, writing an API, which is an application program interface, something along those lines. Basically, an API is an interface to a set of functionality. So I'm writing a program that many people might want to use the functionality behind that program. So the API defines that interface and how users can interact with the software that I've been writing to get the functionality that they're hoping to get out of the software. And there's a lot of, it's not really so much a complicated math problem in terms of how you design APIs. It's more, how do you find ways to remove friction between the code that you're writing and how your clients are interacting with it? How do you make it as easy as possible for your clients to use while at the same time providing the most robust functionality that you can to them? There are a number of other considerations that kind of go into this problem space as well, but I think that when it comes down to designing an API, that's something that a lot of college courses, at least in my experience, don't really touch on so much. It's more, there's just a problem, solve it. And the input to whatever program you're writing for your project is predetermined. So you don't really get that freedom, that ambiguity of, okay, well, the program generically needs to do these things, but how am I going to expose that functionality to my client?
Yeah. An interesting theme that I see or talking with people is this idea of college teaches me how to be a smart individual, but it doesn't allow us to be able to work in the enterprise. And I think that's maybe another great, interesting example for you is this idea of it teaches me how to work in this language, but there's this whole application in the real world where there's so many inputs and outputs of each person that whether it's in a meeting and actually like making a PowerPoint presentation or literally in your case, making a program that has inputs and outputs. I think it's really interesting that continues to carry over even in your case. Do you agree with that sentiment that like college didn't allow you or have a very good way of allowing you to learn how to interact with a huge team?
Yeah, I think I would agree for the most part with that sentiment. I do want to put a small asterisk there and say that, to be fair, I had at least one class in college where I was able to work with the team throughout the whole semester on a group project. And it was nice because I was lucky enough to be in a particular semester where we got to pick that project. I know from talking to older and younger students about that same class that that wasn't always the case. So I think I was also a little lucky in that respect. But that's still one semester out of eight, a single class within that semester. So the vast majority of the classes that I'm taking aren't teaching me how to work with a larger team, like you said. And even beyond the technical issues that come from building out this software, the logistic issues of what it's like to not just work with a team, but work with a team that's part of a larger organization, and your team is interacting with other teams as well. There's multiple layers that you're working within once you get to the enterprise level of software development, especially at a company as large as Google.
So what was that like for you then when, I guess in some cases, you were switching teams between companies? So you leave college, you go work at Epic, you're there for a year, you go work at ConsenSys there and then go to Google. Was each of those points along the route to where you are now something that allowed you to pick up more information, maybe technically about software engineering, but then also how to work in those teams and maybe even different processes? Because I imagine each company does things a little bit different as you're trying to build this kind of overall body of knowledge about how you do your job.
Yeah, definitely. Every single job was its own learning experience. And even beyond just picking up little tidbits of how to handle certain situations within the workspace, or what it's like to write enterprise software versus academic software, I also learned that every company that you're going to work at is very different in its own way. And I think that I was lucky enough to have a trajectory in my career where I worked at three different companies that were all very different from each other, versus say somebody starts working at Facebook and then they move to Apple and then they move to Google. Those are three very different companies, but there's going to be a lot more overlap between those companies versus working at a software company in the Midwest like Epic that has some of those Silicon Valley tendencies that a lot of the companies out here try to have in terms of culture. But it still ran very, very differently from a West Coast company. Then moving to a company like ConsenSys that was originally a small startup and still kind of felt like one, but is now absorbed by this larger company. So you kind of feel that tension between the agility of a startup versus the safety and bureaucracy of a larger corporation. And then finally landing in that larger company that admittedly is sort of set the culture standard for a lot of the tech company culture in the Bay Area and around the world. Not so much, and lately I think there are a lot more companies contributing to those tendencies, but Google certainly started a lot of the trends.
It sounds very interesting, the different dynamics between companies. I mean, I think that's broadly there for a lot of people. I'm wondering if you can maybe explain that more technically. I think what I'm interested here is something that, as I don't know, I guess someone to the peripheries of programming, mean like a self-taught programmer, I don't have a lot of fundamental experience. If I write small programs myself, like, okay, maybe I write two things that interact with each other, whatever. It seems amazing to me that you could have literally thousands of people working on essentially one body of code and have it all work. Because for me, if I write two things that interact with each other, I feel like I have to intimately know what both things are doing in order to understand how they're going to actually work effectively together. And so I'm curious, maybe if you could just give a little bit of time talking about how do you sit in the bigger picture in terms of you write the code, how does it go through the organization, and how does it actually work once all the thousands of people that have written their small bits comes together into one functioning thing?
Sure. I think that really goes right back to what I was describing earlier about designing an API. That is really, APIs exist to exactly solve these sorts of problems. I have a team of eight other engineers that I'm working on right now, and the transcoding team has their own set of, 10 or so engineers. And then there's another team that writes the framework for that engine that's got another 10 or so engineers, and so on and so forth. There's all these different teams that when you look at just their project, sure, maybe you can digest and see how you're able to manage that work amongst, 8 to 10 people. But in order to get all of these disparate projects working together to serve one larger purpose, that's where software engineers write APIs and say, okay, me on the Venom team writing this interface for the processing engine, we have X, Y, and Z entry points into this API to do three different operations that we support. So then somebody on YouTube or a team on YouTube that says, okay, I'm the uploads team. I have this video. I now need to get it transcoded and stored so that we can serve it back to the rest of our clients. I know that you've defined these three operations as a part of your public API. I don't need to worry about what the underlying implementation of those operations are. I just need to know what that contract is in terms of how to interface with your system. Similarly, my team interacts with an API that the Viper team, they're the ones that make the processing engine. They have a similar API that they put out. And we say, okay, we don't need to know the details of how you're transcoding these videos so much, but we just need to know what your contract is in order to perform this discrete set of operations that we need to have access to. And so then we're able to call into those various operations as well. There's a variety of different ways you can implement an API. There are a variety of different ways you can communicate between two different pieces of software in order to send, say, requests over to that API. And it's really just one of the most challenging parts of working within a large enterprise organization, or even just an organization that maybe is writing software that other companies can plug their software into. Now you're talking about cross-company boundaries. One of the most challenging things is figuring out what that API needs to be, because the functionality, the core functionality of your system is already defined, is relatively well-defined. You know what you want the system to do. Now you have to figure out what's the best way, the simplest way, the most effective way for our clients to interact with this functionality without overwhelming them with 80, 90, 100 different hooks that they can plug into.
Are those the kind of decisions then that you would make, or is that a member of your team, or is that kind of come down from maybe a larger project manager then, with all these decisions that have to be made about how you're making an API, how you're going to interface with maybe, say, outside customers in this case?
So that's getting into something that's definitely going to be an organizational decision. So for example, when I was working at Epic, I personally did not have that much control over how this API was going to get designed. It was also a very different type of system. So there wasn't as clear cut of APIs being designed within Epic system. When I moved over to ConsenSys, I had a little bit more say in how these APIs were getting designed, but ultimately there was a product manager that was telling me, hey, we need to be able to do X, Y, and Z thing. Make your API so that you can support these things. So it was sort of like a 50-50 deal where there's a lot that's being dictated to me from the business side. And then I'm making some decisions on how I can best fit these needs that they dictated.
It's got to largely be the size of your company. If you're a smaller company, I imagine you have more bandwidth to be able to do what you want. And I mean, you have to live with more of the decisions that you make, because I assume from a software architect position, that's a challenging thing to understand. Like, if you set these rules of APIs need to be designed like this, to know that that'll function as it gets expanded out into whatever it becomes.
Oh yeah. Scalability is always an issue. You know, how do we say, okay, this is the functionality we have right now, but we can envision all of these other things that we may want to add to the system that can add value for our customers. So writing your code to be what we call extensible and general use, or writing your code to be modular. So it's like really, really small, easily digestible chunks that you split your code up into so that you can easily plug in more chunks that bring in more functionality. That's always a really big consideration as well in terms of how you design your system. And that can have an impact, obviously, on the API that you're writing, because suddenly you may have functionality that means that you're going to need to expose a new way of plugging into that functionality for your clients. But it's also a really big consideration in terms of just how you maintain your system. How do you make your life easier moving into the future so that if you want to add new stuff, you're not going to be hating all of the decisions you made in the past?
What does all this look like for you then on a day-to-day basis? I think hopefully as society as a whole, we can somewhat move past the idea that people who are doing software engineering, computer programming, coding for a living are not just sitting around in hoodies with their hoods up and their headphones on, tuning out the world. But what does it look like for you on a daily basis in terms of how much time are you writing software? Are you stuck in meetings a lot just like everyone else? Is there a lot of team collaboration? What would an average day look like?
If I had to give a average number on how much time I spent coding, I usually fall back and say around 60 or 70% of my time coding. Again, that's something that can change from company to company, depending on what sort of responsibilities you're going to have and how the company decides that they want to run their software engineering department. But at least at Google, I think those numbers are roughly accurate. And what makes it interesting is that it changes over time. I'm not coming in and doing the same thing every single day, which is what makes the whole job really exciting and really rewarding. When I'm starting up a new project, I might not be doing a whole lot of coding right off the bat. There's going to be a lot of design work that needs to be done. And one of the things that's really nice about Google is that I get to write my own designs pretty early on in my career here. So when I first came in, I might be working on designs or reading designs that another engineer who's been on the team for a while wrote, but pretty quickly, within a year, I was writing my own designs. And so I go through that whole process that could take, you know, a few weeks, however long, however complicated the design is, and then I can really start getting into the meat of the coding. And so I'm spending most of my time at that point coding up the project, getting my tasks done, meeting my milestones. And then once you get to the launch of the project, again, that's going to be less coding and a lot more monitoring. So we're starting to roll out whatever software changes that we've made for this project. And we want to make sure we're monitoring them, making sure they're working properly. We want to make sure that we're setting up alerts. We have automated alerting systems at Google, and there are plenty of different solutions that other companies use as well for this, to tell us if something is breaking within our system. So it's a bit of a cycle in terms of where you're at with your project. In terms of meetings, I personally don't find myself in meetings, a lot of meetings frequently. There will be spikes at times where, oh, you know, this random week I had a lot of meetings, or this random day I was stuck in meetings all day. But it's nice that I feel like I'm relatively free within my job to just get my work done and not be stuck in meetings all the time. But I do know that as I progress within Google, as I start getting promoted and reach higher levels within the engineering ladder, that will likely change over time. I'll likely be in more meetings as I become more influential, I guess, in the vision of our software and our project.
So it sounds like you have this cycle, I guess, for each project. Does it mean that you're also supporting many projects, meaning like you might be in the make sure it continues to run stable in project A, but you're also developing project B in parallel?
Definitely. You want to make sure that your engineers always have something to do. It's not a matter of overworking your engineers, but you don't want that dead time, because if you have engineers that aren't doing any work, they're not going to be happy. You're not going to be happy because you're not getting, you know, everything that you can out of them. And so, yeah, a project starting up will certainly overlap with the end of a project. And I might even be running two projects in parallel. It could be that rather than doing one really big project that, you know, I'm going to need to focus all of my time on, I may be working on two smaller projects in parallel. And those projects may not have started at the same time. So I might be managing two different projects or even three different projects at different stages within their life cycle.
Gotcha. That makes sense. Yeah, it's interesting to think about that. And yeah, to your point, it's got to be a difficult thing, especially for your management, to maintain that balance of keeping people sufficiently busy, but also not putting too much on their plate so they're stuck in analysis paralysis of what to do every day because they're just got too many things to do.
Yeah, for sure. I've been lucky to have two phenomenal managers during my time at Google. I've been on the same team since I started at Google, but I'm on my second manager now within this team. My first one moved to a different team, and they've both been absolutely fantastic, great mentors. And yeah, like you said, it's impressive how they're able to manage all of these different feature requests and bugs and scalability problems, all these different things that need to go into our system or be fixed or worked on within our system, and be able to prioritize those and assign them effectively.
Eric, you mentioned that further on in your career, your day-to-day might change, your job requirements or your extra job responsibilities might change. What does that look like in your position? So I guess maybe two questions. What is the current title of the position you're in, and what are the potential career paths from here on?
So if I assume that I'm just going to be staying at Google, there's what we call ladders internally, and they define the progression of your career to a certain general sense within your job role. So I would be on the software engineering ladder. Software engineers typically come in at what we call level 3. There are associated titles for each of the levels that I can't remember offhand what they are. Usually we just speak in terms of what number are you on the ladder. So if you're fresh out of college, you got a bachelor's in computer science, you're starting your first job, you're going to start at level 3 on the engineering ladder usually. And then it goes all the way up to, say, like level 9 or something like that. I think it goes pretty high up. One of the really nice things about Google is that there's not really a ceiling for you if you're an engineer. They explicitly wanted to design the career progression for an engineer so that if you are an exceptional engineer, you can continue progressing your career indefinitely and continue taking on more challenging problems, more ambiguous problems, and larger problems that could even impact the company at large as opposed to just your product. So right now I'm a level 4, working on trying to make my way to level 5. And many engineers will end up at level 5 and just kind of stay there. That seems to be, from what I can tell, the natural progression for many engineers is going 3 to 5, but certainly there are plenty that make it beyond 5 to 6 or 7 or higher.
Leveling up, how fitting. Do you guys celebrate it with like a level up party like this? It's funny. It's the way you said it. Like I'm working on level 5. It's like you're working on, leveling up.
Yeah. It kind of cracks me up. There used to be a culture around, celebrating promos, and some of that has kind of gone away, I guess. But yeah, it's always, it's always really exciting whenever somebody on your team gets promoted. Usually at the very least, everyone go out to lunch together and have a little celebration. You don't normally see like a larger organization like celebrating, here are all the people in our organization that got promoted, just to make sure that, anybody who maybe didn't get promoted that cycle isn't feeling left out.
Sure. So a follow-up back to your ladder comment. Is that just a technical ladder, or is management also included in that same ladder?
That ladder is just technical that I was describing. I think the numbers are relatively normalized to be roughly translatable in terms of, how much experience or expertise you have from ladder to ladder. But there's going to be a different ladder for managers and for, say, like product managers or project managers or team managers, whatever. Business people probably have their own ladder too. I'm not entirely sure. I'm just familiar with the engineering ladder.
Sure. What are some of the base requirements for someone to even start getting a job at Google? You came there after working at two other companies before. Is that how it is for most people? It's already having industry experience before coming into the company, or are there people getting hired direct out of college?
No, you can definitely get hired directly out of college. I'm actually mentoring one of the new team members that just came onto our group, and he came straight out of college, actually. So it's certainly very common. Actually, it's not an outlier situation either that you got a job at Google straight out of college. There's plenty of situations where that happens. So it's really just kind of up to you and what your particular career trajectory is. In terms of being ready for getting that job, that's a hard thing for me to kind of say in concrete terms. Obviously, I can't talk about what specific interview questions I'm going to be asking when I interview a candidate. But in general, we look for people that have strong problem-solving skills, have a pretty good baseline in terms of computer science theory. It's not a strict requirement, I don't think, that you have a degree in computer science. But there's a lot of techniques that you would learn in such a degree that are extremely invaluable throughout any problem space within software engineering. We like our candidates to have those skills. And then on top of that, just knowing that you already know how to code. We don't care if you code in a language that maybe the team you land on doesn't use. We just want to make sure that you have coding skills and in general, you know how to write good, clean code.
That's interesting what you said about not everyone having a computer science degree and being able to work at Google. I think from my perspective, it's I'm an engineer because I have a degree, not necessarily because of the work that I do. And so I'm interested to hear your take on that in terms of do people value that degree more than others, or is it just technical chops? If you can, you know, show that you are competent and you can perform those skills, then that's all you need. We don't even care.
Yeah, for sure. When I go to interview a candidate at Google, I'll take a peek at their resume just out of curiosity, see where they have experience, what kind of experience they have. It can sort of help guide maybe some of the questions that I might decide to ask that candidate, because I might want to drill into some of that expertise. But I'm not explicitly looking for them to have a computer science degree. Having one is certainly useful from a practical standpoint because, you know, to get that degree, there are a lot of things that you have to learn and skills that you'll have to learn that are going to be very useful in the workplace. But I think that software engineering specifically is pretty unique in the sense that I can grab a laptop, get an internet connection, pop it open, and start learning how to program, which is super cool to think about that you could really become just in your bedroom working on coding projects if you put in that time. A fantastic and very knowledgeable engineer. And I may be speaking out of turn here, so I apologize if my unfamiliarity with other engineering disciplines starts to show. But when I think of a mechanical engineer in contrast, you know, you're, let's say, designing parts for a tooling company, that's something that's going to be a lot more challenging to do if I'm just grabbing a laptop, a cheap laptop, with an internet connection and starting to work. You know, you have to grab, say, CAD software that you want to use to design those parts. You need to know what parts you're designing for. And then even then, you need to get those parts manufactured, see how well they perform, all that sort of stuff. So I think that software engineering is just, if you're not going to college or if you didn't go to college, or if you just studied something else in college, it's a lot more approachable to the general public to try getting into that particular discipline.
I can definitely understand that. I think in my job specifically, I can't just work from home every day. I have to be at work, working in vehicles, doing stuff on a work computer. So you're definitely not far off in that.
Yeah. Are you able to work from home, Eric?
Yeah, actually, funny enough, I did today. So I can. It's at Google, there is a pretty generous work from home policy. So it's not recommended or really encouraged that you have a permanent work from home or a permanent work remote setup within your team. Google typically likes you to be present more often than not. So usually it's just a situation like, oh, you know, I have a doctor's appointment in the middle of the day that's much closer to home than it is to the office, rather than throwing this big old commute in the middle of the day that's just going to sap out my work time. I'm just going to work from home, pop out for, say, 30 minutes for the doctor's appointment. That's 5 minutes from my house, come back and finish out the day working from home. Or maybe I feel like I might be coming down with a cold or something, don't want to get people in the office sick. I might decide to work from home that day. But in general, I try to be in the office, and we really want people to be in the office because you really are more productive when you can be around your teammates and be able to easily communicate with them just on an ad hoc basis.
I agree. I really like the work from home philosophy as a way to mitigate obvious inefficiencies in work. I mean, your case is maybe different, and the commuting out west, from what I know, is atrocious. So this idea of, can I help prevent my productive employee from being unproductive for 2 hours a day sitting in their car? And what ways can I help empower my employees to be more productive? I think it sounds like the way that it's implemented at Google, it's very appropriate in that regard. It's, hey, try to be in as much as possible. But if there's a logical situation where you're going to be really unproductive just because of a policy of you have to work in the office, then let's change it up and be smart about it.
Yeah, for sure. That's I think you hit the nail on the head there.
What do you do to stay maybe up to date in the field? And maybe I'm thinking about maybe side projects you do at home. Are you big into doing your own coding projects for fun as a hobby at home as a way to keep learning, or maybe just exercise what you're doing at work in maybe a different aspect? Or Or do you even have maybe some more formal education at work on the job type provided training that allows you to keep up to date? Because it seems like the landscape is changing almost daily in terms of what's popular, what people have to learn, what new software language comes out. And I imagine learning all that can be quite a challenge. Or maybe in your case, it's less of a change in a company and more of what happens for everyone in the hobby side.
Yeah, it's definitely a ever-changing landscape in terms of what's popular, what's growing in software engineering. And if you're an independent coder, maybe you're just learning at home on the side, or you're doing independent contracting work, that can be really intimidating to stay on top of, especially if you're somebody that works in the front end. So you're, you know, designing websites, designing user interfaces that people are interacting with. JavaScript is really, really notorious for having libraries that change from day to day, what's popular and what's not. Once you're at a company, on the other hand, you know, things are a lot more static. There are standards within the company. There are chosen libraries that have been approved. So it's not as big of an issue there. But you're right. I do like to try to stay on top of what's kind of changing in industry when I'm at home to at least some degree. And so I will do coding projects at home. I guess I say I do it to stay on top of what's going on in industry, but also a pretty big part of it is I just enjoy solving problems, little tiny coding problems, maybe like really mathy problems that don't have a whole lot of practical application maybe within what I'm working on, but they're just fun for me to solve, like tiny little riddles. And so I'll look for different projects online. Like there's Top Coder is one website. We just came out of the holiday season. There's a website called Advent of Code that goes up every year. That's like a digital advent calendar where every single day on the calendar is a different coding problem that's split up into two parts. And I'll use those sorts of projects or websites to help myself maybe learn a new language. So I recently finished this year's Advent of Code, or last year's, I guess. And I use that as an opportunity to teach myself a language called Rust, not a language that I'm going to be using at work. My team codes primarily in C++ and Go. But it was just really cool to be able to learn this new young language that seems to have a lot of really awesome potential within the industry. And I hope that it continues to grow.
For someone that knows a lot of languages like yourself, what advice would you give to someone who's starting? Maybe they feel really good in one language, they're picking up a second one. Are there some things that you would recommend to that person that would help them as they advance in their career where they'll learn, you know, tens of languages?
So I would say actually not to worry about it too much. A lot of companies will not necessarily expect you to be an expertise in a specific language. There are certainly plenty that are. They'll post on the job description, you know, we want somebody that knows PHP, or we want somebody that knows Python. And obviously then if you really want that job, yeah, you're going to have to go and learn that language. But I wouldn't necessarily make it a point, unless it's just something that you really enjoy doing, to go out and learn a wide breadth of languages. If you learn one language and get really, really good at it, then it makes it a lot easier to learn other programming languages. There are different paradigms out there, different designs, and so some languages can look really, really weird if you're coming from a very different language. But at the end of the day, there's a lot of core programming concepts that are shared that underpin a lot of these languages. So I would say if you're really good at one language and you're looking to expand to another one, if you can find one that seems to be used really commonly, C++, Java, Python, JavaScript, those are four extremely common languages within industry. Pick up one of those and give it a shot and start solving some problems and get familiar with it. Otherwise, if you're perfectly comfortable doing your work, your personal projects in whatever language you've chosen, I would say do it opportunistically. You know, if you're looking at a job opportunity that really interests you and it appears to require a particular language, use that as your impetus, I guess, to start learning that new language, because you'll pick up on it probably faster than you would expect to if you're pretty proficient in a different language.
I love the parallels to language. I mean, programming language is so perfect, right? It's very similar to even spoken language. A lot of people say if you pick up one language and then pick up another, it gets easier and easier, because while some things are different, a lot of things are the same. Like And I think that's awesome because the analogy seems to fit so well to computer programming language as well. If you know what a variable is, yeah, maybe the syntax is different between languages, but it's still, if once you understand architecture, then you're just really just figuring out the syntax.
Exactly. Knowing it's really, if you know what you want to do in a program, it's really easy to just hop online, Google what you're trying to do for your particular language and see either if your language supports it or if you maybe need to import a library that allows you to do what you're trying to do or what have you. So the more important part is knowing what you want to do from a very technical sense. And then it's jumping off to a new language becomes just a matter of entering the cycle of Google what I need to do, implement it, start to memorize it, move on to the next thing.
So as a professional in the field of this case where you Google things a lot, is that the tool? Meaning, you know, as a professional person who is going to go out and figure out how to do things, would Google be your tool to try to figure out, can I do X in this language?
Sure. I'll usually just throw it into Google. And I personally know that I'm going to get results from a few different sites that I visit frequently on that particular topic. So if you're talking about specific sites that I'm going to, Stack Overflow is a really common one. Any software engineers that might be listening to this episode have probably been to Stack Overflow countless times for, you know, advice on how to solve a programming problem or just to see if somebody else had a similar problem as them. Reddit, honestly, isn't a bad place to go to sometimes, especially for if you're dealing with a young language like Rust. It could really, the language or the, even if it's a framework that you're learning that's new as well, has a really active community. Odds are it'll be on Reddit or maybe a forum site run by the people that designed that language or framework. And then even going on to a place like GitHub, which is a service where people can store their coding projects, and searching through GitHub for a library that might be useful for what they're trying to do is another good resource. But all of these things are easily accessible if you just kind of Google the problem, and you'll start to recognize the different websites that are probably going to get you the best answers.
When you were at Michigan Tech, you were actually competing in programming contests. I'm really interested to learn more about that from you and what that was like.
Yeah, that was that was not something I ever envisioned myself doing until I did it. It was pretty cool. So the contests that I entered in were part of ICPC, which is the Intercollegiate Programming Contest. It's a global contest. This contest is put on by the Association of Computing and Machinery, ACM. And the kind of general format of these contests is that you're on a team of three people. It's a strict requirement that you have three people. You can't enter with fewer. And you get a set of problems that you need to solve within 3 hours, I think, if I'm remembering correctly. And you might get anywhere from 8 to 12 problems. It really depends on the contest and the difficulty of the problems that year. And so you want to try to solve all of those problems as quickly as you can. So every time you solve a problem, you send the code, you throw the code onto a flash drive, or you transmit it in some way to a judge. They run the inputs for that particular problem through your code. And if you get the correct answers quickly enough, then they consider you as having solved that problem. And you get a number of points equal to the number of minutes that have passed since the start of the contest. So if you solve a problem, say, 20 minutes into the contest, that problem is worth 20 points. You solve the next problem 30 minutes into the contest, that problem is worth 30 points. So it's sort of like golf, where you want the fewest points possible. And then the rankings are done by first by who solved the most problems and then broken down by points. You also get penalties if you submit an incorrect solution. So you're always trying to make sure that you know for sure that you're solving the problem correctly before you submit it. Because if you end up getting it wrong and have to rewrite your solution, then not only are you wasting time, but you're also getting a point penalty if you do ultimately solve that problem.
So is this kind of like the sports of computer programming in some ways?
I guess, if you want to think about it that way. I did manage to make it to the world finals 1 year. I will admit that I was very lucky to be on the team of one very brilliant computer scientist and one very brilliant mathematician. So I can't really claim a whole lot of credit for getting us to the world finals, but there were, I think, 100 teams or 300 teams at the World Finals of three contestants each. And these are from regions all over the world. So, you know, there might have been, say, 10 teams from the US or something like that. I don't remember exactly how many. So there's certainly many people around the world, many students around the world that are doing these programming contests. But I wouldn't necessarily call it as something as big as like football or esports or basketball or what have you, like a traditional sport. But it's certainly the closest we got.
It sounds like a lot of fun. It sounds like a cool way to take something that you love and do it in a fun way and have you learn while you do it. I'm sure you learned an incredible amount while you did that, which is, I think, is awesome. I think I'd like to transition, you know, we're coming up on time and things, but one thing I really want to get from you is this idea. You're a person who's gone through a change in life that I think a lot of people have thought about whether they can do it or should do it or want to do it. And it's this idea of moving westward. I mean, essentially moving from the Midwest, in your case, moving west and working for a tech company. That idea, I think, is present in a lot of people's minds. And I'm just curious your reflection on that, both in the idea of as you thought about moving west, you talked a little bit about you needed to because of that's the software engineering hub, but maybe if you could talk a little bit about that, but then really more about your reflection of what it's like now that you've been there. Was it what you thought or anything else?
Sure. So being out west is kind of like if you went to school at a Midwestern school, then being out west as a software engineer can kind of be this gleaming gem, something that you really want to strive towards. And that was certainly the case for me. And when I first got out here, I was super excited about it. I was thinking, you know, I finally made it. I'm out working in Silicon Valley. I'm working in San Francisco. That must mean I finally made it as a software engineer. And I think the first piece of advice I would give would be to caution people that thinking that you have to make it to the Bay Area to be a successful software engineer, because that's definitely not the case. You can be a phenomenal software engineer, a phenomenally successful software engineer as well, in a variety of different places, not just around this country, but around the world. It's an exploding industry. And the Bay Area is certainly a tech hub and one of, if not the largest tech hubs in the world, but can only expand so far. Companies are moving to cities like Seattle or Denver. There is plenty of tech opportunities in New York and Boston. So if you're looking at San Francisco as like, I have to be there to be a successful engineer, but you don't really want to be out there, you're not sure if it's a place that you want to live, then do yourself a favor and certainly look in either your location if you're in a place that you like, or look at other cities that you're maybe interested in, because I think you'll be surprised at how many different opportunities that you can find. Even if you want to work at Google, for example, Google has plenty of offices all over the country and all over the globe. So if being in the Bay Area itself, if being there as a place to live is not necessarily an attractive thing to you, then look at those other locations too, and you might be a lot happier for it. For me personally, I was, you know, I'm happy to have moved out here, but it's certainly not as awesome as I think maybe I had originally hyped it up to be in my head. I don't regret coming out here, but I don't think I'm going to be out here long term necessarily. Eventually, I'm probably going to be looking at other cities that maybe better fit my lifestyle and my culture that I'll move to work at in the future, and hope, you know, many of those cities that I'd be interested in working in have Google at them too, which makes it easy to transfer.
Yeah, Eric, that sounds like some really good advice, and interesting to hear your story in that you don't necessarily have to go across the country to find something. You might just be able to find something in your own community, or at least your own state if you're looking for it.
For sure. And I don't mean to sound discouraging either. You know, if you really feel that the Bay Area is where you want to be and that's a place that you want to live, then man, go chase it. Like, if that's your dream, do it. And, you know, work hard at it. And it'll be really rewarding once you achieve it.
I think it's great to have people realize, too, this idea of move to a place where you want to live. It's fortunate that that career allows you to do that. If you have an environment that you want to live in, go there and you can also do this job. I mean, some jobs you can't do that. Some jobs you have to be in this geographic location to do it. And I think this sounds like that's not the case for this, which, I mean, it's kind of assumed based on programming and just being able to have an internet connection, and you're pretty much good to go. But I think even with that, though, I also felt like that was a similar mentality. Like, you have to move to the West Coast if you want to be serious about computer science and software engineering. But I think it's awesome that that's not necessarily the case.
Yeah, for sure. You hit the nail on the head. And I think that's something that I wish I had known a little bit better, or at least had been told when I was in college and really hyping up this dream of going out west, that, you know, there are plenty of amazing opportunities in other cities as well. Like I said, I don't regret it, but I think that's probably one of the best pieces of advice that I can give in terms of where you go with your career if you're looking to get into software engineering.
Awesome. Well, Eric, before we let you go, do you have any final advice for someone who might be in college or is just starting out in their career in software engineering? What's that one parting piece of wisdom you wish you might have known before you started?
Write your own tests. If you're coding, write your own tests. You know, you'll hate doing it, but you'll love that you did it down the road.
There it is. All right.
I appreciate it, Eric. Have a good day, man.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on, you guys. I really appreciate being able to talk with you about this.
Man, another great episode. Really interesting to talk to Eric about software engineering. I think he did a great job explaining it to someone who has like that periphery knowledge of programming, but to really see how you take that and run with it and make it your career.
Yeah, definitely. He did a good job of explaining all that. And I didn't really know what happens behind the scenes at a lot of these big internet programs we're using, whether it's YouTube, Google, or whatever. So it was really interesting to see how that's working and how it's similar to other things in engineering of products we use daily. You know, there's a huge team behind it, and they're doing all the different jobs they have to do to make it happen.
Yeah, I think for me, one of the most interesting takeaways is this idea of enterprise programming is a lot different than solo programming. Largely built around this API difference. But I think there's a lot of engineers that probably do some very basic programming frequently, you know, building their own basic code. And I think it's really helpful to see how you could expand that into more robust through APIs and other things. But I think it's also just good for the people who are maybe in college or maybe thinking about career change going into it, that it is different. It's a different skill set, being able to program and then be able to do enterprise programming. And I think it's good to have that big picture and be intentful about that, especially in college. I mean, the discussion around college may be helping with that a little bit, but definitely not the best environment to really, really gain a lot of that enterprise programming expertise. I thought that was a really key point.
Yeah, I totally agree. I thought his comment on languages specifically was pretty interesting, how it's not necessarily expected for you to know all the languages that you might be using in the job. I think, at least thinking about myself, when I was trying to learn how to program and code on the side, I was always searching, like, what is the best programming language to learn to start? And you get all these different opinionated posts about it or something. But for people who are out there doing it, it sounds like it's much more like, do you have kind of these basic technical skills and problem-solving skills? And if you have those, you can learn the language if you already understand the basics of it and go from there.
Yeah, I think that's good advice. I think because it's hard. I mean, it seems like it's so daunting. Like, there's so many languages, but, you know, get good at one and then you can transfer those skills as needed for the job.
Yeah, I don't necessarily plan on becoming a software engineer anytime soon, but I feel like I have a little bit better idea of what I would need to do.
Yeah. Interesting also his comments on moving to the West Coast. I thought that was an interesting thing. It seems to, I mean, maybe it's not the case now, but I feel like 5-10 years ago, it seemed like that was the thing, move west. And that's enlightening and I think positive that his opinion on that and the ability that you don't necessarily have to. I guess you really don't have to, you know, pick the place you want to live and there's likely a lot of opportunity there.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of opportunities that we might not think of initially. I think where I work in automotive, there's actually a huge number of software engineers writing it. It may not be the software that we think of on our laptops or on the internet, but software is powering the electronics and the control systems behind a lot of things we use every day. And that for someone, there might be opportunities in industries they weren't thinking about, and maybe they can apply their skills to solve different problems beyond just cruising through a web page or making the newest and latest and greatest app.
Yeah. Well, man, another good episode. Thanks for your time. Appreciate the discussion. Hope you have a great week, buddy.
Yeah, you too. It's good talking to you as always, Troy.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Thanks for listening to this episode of Engineer Your Career with Troy Bauman and Brennan Timrak. For more information about the show, visit our website at eycpodcast.com. There you can find show notes for each episode and get in touch with Troy and I. If you or someone you know are an engineer with an interesting or even not so interesting career journey and would like to be on the show, go on the website, send us a short bio, and we may just invite you to come on and share your story. And finally, if you want to show your support, please rate, review, like, or subscribe to the show on your podcast player of choice.